I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum, I think barely. We were just coming over from session, and so that's why we're delayed. I apologize to everybody here for that. Before we get started on our agenda today, just wanted to go over a few things. Everyone here today must be seated when they are in the hearing room. There will be no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles, and if you need any accommodation, please communicate that with our staff. Signs are also not permitted in the hearing room, either in the audience or at the testifier table. So if you have signs, please leave those outside. We'll not tolerate any outbursts or clapping or any kinds of disruptions. We do have several bills on the agenda today. I am the author of several of them, so I'm going to move up to the testifier table, but actually we need to do the minutes first. So let's just take care of that. Let's see. Representative Curran, would you move for approval of the February 13th, 2024 minutes?
Yes, Chair, that is my motion.
All right, any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February 13, 2024 have been approved. And I will go ahead and turn the gavel over. So the first bill on today's agenda is House File 3398, which is Representative Mueller's bill. We will be laying this bill over. Therefore, I will, or would you like to move, or I guess I'm moving to lay this bill over, House File 3398. And Representative Mueller, your bill is before us, so please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So this bill is providing additional funding for crime victim services. Crime victim services provide critical resources and assistance to victims and survivors of crime throughout the state of Minnesota. I have a number of testifiers here who can get into more detail on that. I just want to emphasize the chart that you have in your packets that describe the kinds of services that advocates provide to victims and survivors throughout the state. Advocacy programs are critical to public safety. They are critical services to victims and survivors, and I can't emphasize that enough. Last year we did fund, we did an increase to the base, but it wasn't enough to cover the need we have. One of the problems that's going on right now is the federal funds. It's called VOCA funding, and there is nationwide that funding it has stopped or decreased. And so we filled that gap last year and added a little bit on. I was hoping that the feds would start picking that up again, and it doesn't look like they're going to do that anytime soon. It would take an act of Congress, so that might indicate why it might not happen anytime soon. And so we are in dire straits with victim services in our state right now. And again, the testifiers will talk about that. One of the other things we had done last year with the tax bill and the public safety aid was we made sure that victim services programs would be eligible for that aid. And what I'm hearing, and we're going to get some more data on this, is that they just didn't get any of that. Locals had, again, the needs were great, and no criticism to how different local communities decided to allocate that fund, but it doesn't sound like it was really going to victim services. So that was not a path for them to get the additional funding that they need. And as of now, I know of at least one domestic violence shelter that's closed because of their funding issues. Mm-hmm. I do want to point out to you in the packet as well, you've got the letters of the coalitions who really work with all the advocates across the state, but included in that letter you have sign-ons from people who support this. This is law enforcement. These are the County Attorneys Association. Many individual county attorneys' office signed this. You've got supervision agents. This is statewide support because throughout the state, those in the public safety realm know how critical these programs are for victims and survivors and for the justice system to function. The need, so with the grant money that they do get that comes through Office of Justice programs, they were able to allocate $60 million. The need, though, was $102 million. And so much like we talk about in the Judiciary Committee, the need to fully fund public defenders, we need to fully fund these services. They are critical to our system working. I understand that this year isn't a budget year, but I am leading with this bill so that we can highlight how important these services are throughout the state. And with that, Madam Chair, I would turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. We have several individuals who are here to testify in support of the bill. As a reminder, please state your name and your title for the record when you come up. First on the list is Pahua Vang, Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And just so that people know who's next, Bobby Holtberg will be next if you wanted to be ready to jump up.
Good morning. My name is Pahua Vang. I'm the Interim Executive Director. I'm in CASA, the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Madam Chair and members of the House Public Safety Committee, I'm here today with my fellow coalition directors. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak with you today on an issue of critical importance to Minnesotans. We are testifying in support of House File 3398, which provides a critical increase to crime victim services through the Office of Justice program. This funding is desperately needed so that survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and general crime can access the services and support they need to care for themselves and their families. We need you to invest in survivors. House File 3398 is supported by each of the six statewide coalitions working to end violence and abuse in our state, Violence Free Minnesota, the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, and Minnesota Children's Alliance, the Sacred Hoop Coalition, and the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. Our coalitions represent over 200 programs serving more than 68,000 victim survivors of violence annually across the state. And today we are joined, many of us joined in this room and virtually, to collectively advocate for a sustained funding increase to meet the needs of our communities and crime victims. Crime victim services are at a crisis point in Minnesota. Due to years of stagnant funding from the state, exacerbated by historic depletion of VOCA funds and cuts at the federal level, crime victim services cannot maintain adequate staffing to provide the most fundamental services for victim survivors in many communities. We have already seen one advocacy program shut its doors from a lack of funding needed to keep its 21-bed shelter operational. These 21 beds served about 200 people every year, and now they are gone. This was the first closure related to the lack of funding increase from last year, but we know without additional crime victim services funding, it won't be the last. We are asking for these funds knowing this is not a full budget year. We urge you to dedicate whatever limited resources you may have to the most vital needs. Our programs will not survive without additional funding, and our communities cannot thrive without advocacy services. Last session, the governor and legislature stepped up to partially fill the 2023 funding hole by adding $10 million to crime victim services over 2 years. This action was much appreciated, and it still does not meet the needs of our members, our communities, and our victim survivors. We sought a needed $40 million increase in base funding for crime victim services last session, and we are urging you to approve $20 million in this second year of the current biennium to address the request, and we need this funding to continue into the future. Our programs face devastating federal cuts in 2023, and we are poised to face them again this year and the foreseeable future. Federal VOCA funding is set to further decrease by an estimated 20% with no promise of rebounding. We are looking at the state to provide this critical support to our public safety services. VOCA funding has accounted for over 60% of funding for crime victim services in our state. Another cut in funding this large without a significant and stable increase at the state level will mean that advocacy programs will close. Survivors will be left without vital resources. My colleague Bobby Holtberg will now share the challenges advocacy programs are facing, the impact of this work, and why funding is so critical now. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And so Bobby Holtberg is next, and then just so that everyone knows who will be after that, it will be Guadalupe Lopez.
Oh, she's left.
Anyway, continue.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. To meet the demands of this moment, our elected officials must invest in victim survivors. As with every helping sector, ours is facing a dramatic staffing shortfall. Working with victims of crime is difficult and highly skilled work done by dedicated advocates. Compassion fatigue and burnout rates are high, and these stresses are compounded by wages that have not come close to keeping up with the cost of living increases. The demand for victim services continues to grow. Programs cannot remain staffed to meet the current need. Community-based advocacy programs are losing highly skilled advocates to places like Walmart and McDonald's, because they simply cannot provide wages that match. Without increased state investment, many of our programs will close. Crime victim services are a critical piece of Minnesota's public safety infrastructure. These programs provide education, direct services, and support to individuals and communities experiencing violence in all forms. They work alongside the criminal legal system by prioritizing victim survivors' physical and emotional safety. They provide legal support, medical care, and mental health services. They address immediate needs like food and shelter. Without these programs, victims and their families will not have opportunities to heal, rebuild after they have been harmed. As we mentioned, this funding supports survivors of general crime, child abuse, trafficking, domestic violence, and sexual violence. Advocacy programs serving survivors are facing enormous challenges due to inadequate funding. Rape crisis centers in Greater Minnesota are often tasked with serving 9 or more counties, which encompass entire regions of the state. Their work can include meeting victim survivors at the hospital for forensic exams at any time of the day or night. These victim advocates carry caseloads of up to 58 clients at one time. They work with survivors of sexual violence in the immediate aftermath of their trauma, as well as providing support for survivors years after their victimization. At least 1 in 3 Native women will be raped in her lifetime, and the vast majority of their perpetrators are non-Native. Services to meet the needs of Native victims must be culturally based and include healing and traditional wellness practices. Tribes and tribal programs need flexible funding to allow for direct financial assistance in times of crisis. Domestic violence is one of the 5 key reasons Minnesotans experience homelessness. A base level increase in funding for crime victim services will support programs' ability to assist victim survivors with housing. This is particularly critical for Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color. In 2021, 24% of Minnesota's victims of intimate partner homicide experienced housing instability. Access to financial stability and affordable housing creates safety for victim survivors of relationship abuse and prevents domestic violence. Child advocacy centers serve kids who have been physically or sexually abused, neglected, trafficked, or have witnessed violence. Although there are over 900 children advocacy centers in the United States, Minnesota only has 13, leaving many child victim survivors without access to trauma-informed services, including forensic interviews, advocacy, mental health, and medical services. Over the past 3 years, prosecutorial-based victim advocates have experienced a sharp increase in statutorily mandated victim notifications they must provide, but they have not received an increase in advocacy resources to provide those critical notifications. There is not one standalone general crime advocacy program in Minnesota, even though the highest rate of reports is from victims of general crime. Minnesota must not leave crime victims without access to advocacy services and resources that they need to restore safety and balance to their lives.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but we're at about 5 minutes and we have several other testifiers, so if you'd like to conclude.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. Today you will hear from survivors of violence who have been positively impacted by victim advocacy programs. Pay attention to the many ways these survivors were served and the depth of knowledge required to do this work. Now consider what will happen if these programs close. Who will do this crucial work? How will individuals and communities escape and heal from violence without these resources? More importantly, how will they prevent future violence?
Thank you so much. Next, we have Cassie Foreman. Oh, and just as a reminder for our testifiers, we are trying to keep our testimony to about 2 minutes. Thank you.
My name is Cassie Foreman, and I am a domestic violence survivor. On October 6, 2015, I called a domestic violence shelter advocate that I knew from church at her home from the back seat of a police car, and I told her I would be coming to the shelter with my daughters to stay. The police were taking us to safety, away from my husband and our broken home. The girls and I had nothing besides what we were wearing and one bag of clothes that the police officer suggested we bring. The officer didn't know what would happen at our house and when we'd be able to come home again. The car ride was simultaneously too long and too short for all the thoughts, fears, and anger swirling through my head. When we got to the shelter, we were greeted with warmth and kindness, but most importantly, we were greeted without judgment. The girls were busied with stuff to do in the shelter, as I had to meet and talk with so many different people. Shelter staff were with me the whole time. We were set up in an apartment in the shelter, and I exhaled a breath that I didn't realize I'd been holding for 14 years. We had our own space. We were safe. While we were staying at the shelter, the staff took the time to get to know my daughters and me. And the encouragement and love I felt from them was amazing. With all the support and connections that I made, I only missed 2 days of work, providing some sense of normalcy when the rest of my world seemed to be turning upside down. The thought of being a single mom scared me. I knew we also wanted to make space for the next family just beginning their escape. The women's shelter helped me find a place to live and got me connected with Safe at Home, the confidential address program. They were able to financially help me with the deposit and the first month's rent. This financial assistance was crucial to helping me establish financial independence and support myself and my girls, as I was still paying the mortgage and utilities on the home we just left and could not afford both of these payments and rent. I have come so far. A few years ago, I was able to buy a house for me and my girls, which has been filled with happiness and joyful memories instead of fear. I did not walk that journey alone. The women's shelter was with me all the way. They are still with me. I love running into shelter staff in public and updating them on how my family is doing. Please support this bill. Please support this life-saving work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we have Lauren Franzen. And after Lauren will be Monica Elisero. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Lauren. I am a survivor of domestic violence. I'm also a domestic violence shelter advocate. Missions Inc. program is located in Plymouth. I'm here today to ask for support in the House File 3398. I've arrived at Missions Inc. Home Free Shelter in 2020 with my one-year-old daughter, Hazel. After experiencing years of physical and emotional abuse, I had been isolated, degraded, beaten, and controlled by my partner. Others witnessed this abuse but did nothing to stop it. I felt broken and alone. I was also recovering. Sorry. I was also recovering from substance use disorder, participating in drug court after receiving several criminal charges, and couch hopping without a stable place to live with me and my daughter. After my probation officer found out what I was experiencing at home, or wherever I was, I was terrified to go to the shelter. He got me connected with Home Free. When I got there, they welcomed me with open arms, never judging me. It made me feel like a person, like a real. I ended up staying at Home Free for 5 months during COVID. During that time, Hazel and I received at least 497 distinct services. And that's just what was formally recorded. I now record services, and some of them don't always get recorded, so I understand. in addition, the shelter basic needs, and here are a few examples of what those services were. I got clothes for me and my daughter, financial assistance in paying past due utility bills, transportation and childcare for my court appearances, help to address evictions on my housing record, referral to financial assistance to purchase a car, help with applying for SSI, SSDI, and ongoing emotional support, assistance with applying for housing programs, which was huge. When I was looking for housing, my advocate sat with me and called the program after program after program. You can't put a price on that support, though, because it's, why would they sit you and do that with you? You know, it's really something that was necessary. Eventually, I was accepted into a housing program with letters of recommendation from Home Free Advocates. I moved into a new place, and for the first time ever, I have all of my kids with me in a safe place. I stayed in touch with the advocates at Home Free for years, and when I was looking for help buying Christmas presents for my kids, one of the advocates suggested I apply for an open job. And so here I am. After everything I've been through, I was scared to work. I couldn't find a job to work with the hours I needed for my daughter's school. But returning to the shelter, I felt like I was coming home. I have been an advocate for several months now. The best feeling in the world is being able to provide somebody with the help I was given there. When I speak to current residents, I let them know that I've been there where they are. I let them know I lived here too, you know, and I just, there's a connection that's so emotional, and it's pretty cool. I'm sharing this story to illustrate the impact of crime victim services on my life and lives of many survivors. When I called Home Free, they were able to take me in, but we turn away over 80% of calls due to lack of the capacity. While we make every effort to connect the callers with resources as an advocate, every denial weighs heavily on our hearts because I know what it might mean for the caller to stay in an unsafe situation. It's painful to think about the prevalence of domestic violence in our community. Right now, you have the opportunity to ensure that when our family, friends, neighbors experience violence, someone is able to support and walk alongside them while they're seeking healing and justice. I want every survivor to be supported as I was, but with programs like ours underfunded year after year, many survivors will be alone. Please help support survivors in domestic violence in our community by voting yes on the House File 3398. Without this funding, many survivors in Minnesota will be unable to access life-saving services. We cannot allow that to happen. Thank you for your time and consideration on this bill, and we're grateful for your important work.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. So next we have Monica Alicero, and after Monica will be Aaron Gutsky. And just a reminder, we're trying to keep our testimony down to 2 minutes because we have a number of people. Thank you so much.
Andrew. Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Moeller, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Monica Alicedio. I come to you today as a mother, a a daughter, a sister, a friend, a member of the board of the Alexander House, but more importantly, as a sexual assault survivor. My introduction to the Alex House began when I was greeted by a victim's advocate as I waited in a hospital room to undergo a rape examination. My advocate prepared me for the painful process of what was to come and sat patiently as the same nurse did her examination. The nurse reported that I presented as a textbook case of a date rape drug, and afterwards, my advocate handed me a folder of resources should I want or need any help. In the days and weeks that followed, the reality sets in that there would be no legal or criminal recourse for what had happened to me. As it turns out, there seldom is for sexual assault cases like mine. Unable to cope with this trauma, my mental and emotional health faltered. I became manic, anxious, and depressed. My doctor put me on medications and offered therapy to no avail. Feeling hopeless and lost, I finally turned to the Alexander House. It was there that I was invited to participate in an intensive small group for survivors. We met weekly and worked to unpack our shared experience. We were given tools and resources to move beyond the fear, shame, and anger so common for victims. The help I received was so profound in my healing journey that it inspired me to join the board. I know firsthand the work we do is instrumental in giving hope to members of our community who have been through the darkest of days. In many cases, we are the only lifeline that exists. I'm deeply troubled that these resources are no longer offered due to financial constraints and cuts to programming. I'm here to request the prioritization of funding for organizations like mine so that we can continue to provide a path from surviving to thriving. I'm determined to give a name, a face, and a voice to victims like me, the ones that we serve, but most importantly, the ones that we can't. What I've learned is that one of the last stages of healing is helping. So if there's any other insights that I could provide that would help to gain your support for this initiative, that would be my goal. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I recently toured Alexandra House and was so impressed. So thank you so much for being here. Next, we have Aaron Gutsky, and after Aaron will be Christy James.
Hello, everybody. Good morning. My name is Aaron Gutsky. I am the executive director of Think Self here in St. Paul. I'm here in support of House File 3398. We serve deaf, deaf-blind, hard of hearing, and late deafened adults around the state of Minnesota. We provide direct services for adults who experience harm caused by domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, and general crime. We also work closely with the Minnesota Department of Education to provide adult education programming to our state's adults who are eager to go into the workforce by providing them with instruction pertaining to English, digital literacy, and driver's education. We are the only deaf-led consortium of adult education in Minnesota and in the country, and one of only 13 organizations nationwide that are tasked with serving deaf survivors of violence. As of this year, we are witnessing an alarming increase in barriers to safety and justice for our survivors and participants that we serve. With the interpreter work stoppage in the court system, we are tasked with navigating the system that is not adequately equipped to provide equitable access to communication by outsourcing language facilitators that are not familiar with our Minnesotans' needs. Our primary goal is to ensure that opportunities to reduce potential harm by barriers are put in place, that are put in place unwittingly by the system and the providers that work with them. It is known that for every hour of direct service that a mainstream agency provides to a survivor without a disability, it takes about 6 hours to work with a deaf survivor. Our advocates are short on time, resources, and support, and we need to desperately expand our slate of employees to better serve those in the community who need us the most. If Think Self does not receive appropriate funding, we will lose our ability to provide thriving wages and expand our programming to better serve those who live in greater Minnesota. We're tasked with bringing our participants out of poverty. And if our staff are also impoverished, how are we expected to ensure the people we serve are uplifted out of poverty? We may be forced to reduce service hours, relocate our offices to save on soaring rent, and limit direct client assistance that our participants sorely need. I'm pleading with the legislature of Minnesota to support our funding through House File 3398 and to ensure that deaf victims of crime are not forgotten or pushed aside by giving us the necessary tools to uplift our underserved community. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Vice Chair Feist, while they're still sitting there, could I ask them just a brief question?
Mm-hmm. Come back.
Oh, yeah.
Since they're already there.
Sorry.
This is a question specifically for this testifier. Is he aware of the language starting on line 115 through 118?
I don't have it in front of me. No.
I'd just like to point out to him, he's saying that he represents a very specific group, and it's a group that I feel is absolutely in need of support, but in the lines that I mentioned, the $20 million that's mentioned in this bill is specifically not going to go to the groups that he represents.
Before our testifier answers, perhaps Chair Moeller would like to respond and clarify.
Yes, if we can, Madam Chair, I'd like to get through the testimony. It sounds like this is not really a question for the testifier, but something I'm happy to address after we get through the other testifiers.
Right. That sounds really good. So we will come back to this question, but for now we're going to get through our remaining testifiers. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Stay with us in case we have questions for you.
Hot seat. Wow, okay.
Thank you so much. Next, we have Christy James, and after Christy will be Guadalupe Lopez.
He does not.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Representative Mueller and the rest of the committee. My name is Christy James, and I am a domestic violence survivor. I almost died at the hands of my ex-boyfriend. For years, he would isolate me from others, demean me, lock me in a closet for days at a time, and beat me for hours. One morning, after I had already left him, he found me at my mother's. I did try to run, but before I could get out of the garage, he pulled me through the open car window, tearing off a chunk of my hair, threw me on the cement floor while kicking, punching, and stomping on me until I lost consciousness. The police arrived with an ambulance. An advocate from the St. Paul Ramsey County Domestic Abuse Intervention Project, or SPIP, met me at the hospital. The advocate stayed with me while the police gathered evidence and pictures, and even though I was terrified and in pain, for the first time I felt that I wasn't alone. SPIP made sure I received medical attention, obtained a protective order, had an ongoing safety plan, received legal advice, and found safe housing. They provided me with 24-hour support, coordinated with the justice system for my ongoing protection, and worked with me throughout the entire criminal process. SPIP and so many programs across the state will have to decrease their services to victims because of lack of funding. Who will answer the call or come out in the middle of the night to offer things you didn't even know you could have? Who will believe you? Who will be there to help you with the whole picture of your life that has been so damaged? SPIP saved my life, and I would not be here without them. I respectfully ask that you please fund these statewide services so other victims will be protected and more lives will be saved, like mine. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And our last testifier who signed up ahead of time is Guadalupe Lopez.
Hello, Chair and members of the House Public Safety Committee. Bonjour, my name is Guadalupe Lopez. I'm the Executive Director of Violence Free Minnesota, the Coalition to End Relationship Abuse. Thank you to the previous testifiers for those important examples of the work, the survival stories that you shared, and the critical needs of programs and the rest of the survivors of Minnesota. Our advocacy programs are reporting record numbers of people reaching out for services. Many of those who seek services are reporting more severe violence, complex family needs, and the increased mental health issues. In recent surveys of advocacy programs, we learned 60% of programs who have will have to drastically reduce services if they do not receive an increase of funding. Imagine the impact that will have on communities and survivors not being able to access services and resources that they deserve and that they need. We need robust and long-term investments in crime victim services in our state, and we need it urgently. We need your support for ongoing increase in base funding for crime victim services. We need your continued commitment to prioritize the safety of our survivors of Minnesota, their families, and the communities across by investing in victim survivors. We urge you to support House File 3398. Miigwech, and thank you.
Thank you so much. And we did have one person sign up from the public to speak, and that is Andrew Morris from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Please proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Morris, and I serve as the Public Affairs and Legislative Liaison at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. I'm here to express the Council's support for House File 3398, offered by Chair Mueller. The Council thanks Chair Mueller and the committee for considering this important legislation at this early opportunity. Addressing gender-based domestic and sexual violence has long been a priority for our Council. As part of its work on this issue, the Council has long encouraged the state to support a holistic approach through the various state agencies and, ideally, to prevent these crimes from occurring. This history includes the Council having spearheaded legislation to establish a pilot program for a domestic violence and sexual assault prevention program that was administered by the Minnesota Department of Health that centered culturally and linguistically relevant programs by community-based organizations. Since that pilot program concluded in 2022, the Council continued to engage with stakeholders, including the Office of Justice Programs and the Department of Public Safety, on how to continue this important work. We are encouraged that this legislation, in addition to providing crucial further resources, prioritizes programs that serve culturally specific and other underserved communities, which are critical to effectively reaching survivors for whom traditional programs may not be accessible. The Council believes that this legislation offers an opportunity to both meet a critical need and to continue and build on previous work and lessons learned to effectively meet the needs of survivors. We encourage the committee to support House File 3398. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and your consideration of this legislation.
Great. Thank you so much. And that will conclude our testimony, and we will move on to the A2 amendment. Who will be offering the A2 amendment? Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Feist, and thank you, Chair Mueller. This is crucial work, and it really is a travesty that FOCA funding hasn't continued. It's a travesty that we're sitting here in a non-budget year and asking for $20 million when 100 yards away I see a building that's being built right now for $730 million that could have had a lot of funding for these groups that do some really, really crucial work. We have four women who just testified who I believe are absolutely heroes. I mean, to go through what they went through and to share that story and ensure that other people aren't left without the resources that they have, that is extremely brave. And thank you. You know, the A2 amendment, we're looking at a projected budget deficit in the out years, and this would just ensure that every single dollar goes towards victims. I know that these organizations are doing some crucial work, but we are in a tight spot, and we should do everything that we can to redirect those funds directly to victims, and that's why I'm going to be offering it and requesting a roll call.
Great. Thank you. A roll call has been requested. Chair Mueller, would you like to address the amendment?
I will, Madam Chair. Thank you. And I am going to urge members to vote no on this. I heard Representative Ingen, you talk about the crucial work these programs provide. You called the testifiers heroes. You said that they deserve the resources that they need. And your amendment actually takes away all of those things from these programs. These programs provide critical services, as they talked about. And your amendment is going to the what used to be called the Reparations Board that provides funding to different victims. Those funds are important, but I will say not all victims are eligible for those funds. They typically pay expenses after the fact, often months in, after the fact. They're limited to qualifying expenses. Again, those are important things, but this is a much more victim-centered way to support victims of crime through their advocates. This support is immediate. You heard from the testifiers that they provide things like transportation, clothing, shelter, food, assistance with medical needs, mental health needs, all of those things. So if we put that money towards this other thing, we're not funding all of those things that we heard about today. So for those reasons, I would urge members to vote no on the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would also urge a no vote on the amendment. Folks may not know, I used to work at the Domestic Abuse Service Center in Hennepin County, work directly with advocates every single day. And when they come here and testify and tell us what they need, we need to listen to them. And frankly, it's it just shows a lack of understanding of how it actually works in practice for them to get these services out to the people that they need them, this A2 amendment in front of us. So when the victim survivors are telling us that they support this language as it is, we need to listen to them. That's actually the respectful thing to do. They know better than any of us in this, any of us here at the table. And so I just respect the work that you do and your support for this bill, and we absolutely should vote no on the A2 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. And I present Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair. And I guess that I'm surprised that, well, I think the victims reimbursement program is probably really important, as the Chair indicated, but you heard from a testifier today that was very clearly that all she had was, it sounded like a grocery bag of clothes. And when these individuals come into these situations, and at EMS I've seen it, and I'm sure our officers across the table have seen it too, that that they have nothing. And it sounds like these programs deal with them and meet them where they're at and are able to give them the support. And I think if it's a reimbursement program, I mean, part of the control a lot of these abusers do is they make sure they have no money, no funds, no way of having access to that. And if we're looking at a reimbursement program, and I'm learning more about reimbursement programs in the EMS world of, yeah, you can be an EMT, we'll reimburse you the $1,600 later, and these are people that don't have a dime in their pocket. So I am against reimbursement programs in this as well as other things, so I cannot support your amendment today, Representative.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Mueller?
Thank you, Chair Feist, and Representative Engen, thank you for this. We had the opportunity, I think, Representative Pinto, you were with me when we were at the library, to listen to many of these agencies and talk about their the programming that they were talking about, not the victims reimbursement thing that we're talking about for A2, but the ones that we were talking about for you, Chair Mueller, in this bill. And one of the complaints they had for me was that how frustrating it was for them to spend all this money and then having to get reimbursements. So this is still reimbursements. It's still the same way. And maybe I'm talking about the wrong thing, but that's what they were telling us. They were telling us that they were frustrated that we're spending money and that then they would have to go back and say and ask for reimbursements, and that then if it didn't qualify, that then they would have be out this money. Now, I could be remembering the wrong agency, and that's fine, but what I'm saying is that the things that we're still talking about, still some of them, at least the ones I was talking to back at the library, fall into the reimbursement unit and so model. So, you know, let's just make sure that when we're talking about reimbursements that it's something that we're making sure we know where all of that is landing. And I'll have more comments to say later, but I think it's really important. I think OJP still has some sort of,
program or some sort of requirements where they still have to, you know, show that the money they spent has fit what they're doing. So I just want to say, this isn't like we're trying to take money. This doesn't take money away from the victim services. This is simply saying that this is going to go through a process that goes directly to the victims through this victims reimbursement fund. So I just want to make sure that we're talking about the same thing and that we're not conflating these two. Thank you, Chair Vice.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, I think what Representative Mueller, what you're referencing was a tour, and this is actually a good chance to thank the chair and staff for putting together some amazing tours and programs over the summer and fall. But that was actually, I think, a completely different group. Those are community violence interruption groups. And what they were describing were, in fact, the challenges, as Representative Hewitt was referencing, of putting money out and then being reimbursed. We are fortunate, as my understanding, I guess the testifier can assist with this, that actually this is not the way this funding works, because it, so it doesn't have the constraints and challenges that we heard about in the library from a different set of groups and that would go forward if this amendment were to go forward. So we're actually really lucky that, and it's really good that that's not how these programs work, and we'd hate to move them in that direction. So I think a different thing that we're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Engen, did you have any final comments?
Yes, thank you, and thanks for the discussion, members.
I'm so sorry, Representative. Novotny.
Thank you, Vice Chair Feist. I'd just like to point out a couple things. Look, we've got objections to the bill, and if you haven't guessed by what I said already, we'll talk about that when we come to the main part of the bill. Referring to this money being taken away and all the money going towards the victims, I'd like to point out that Office of Justice Prevention, the Office of Justice, OJP, takes a substantial cut out of this. So not all of the money will be going to the victims. It's going to go to OJP. We'll talk later about the specific allocations and why that is. But Chair Becker-Finn said that this isn't going to the victims. From their website, Minnesota Crime Victims Reimbursement Programs, things that money can go towards: medical and dental bills, mental health counseling expenses, child care and household services, loss of wages, crime scene cleanup, financial support for dependents of homicide. Look, we don't have an issue. It's just where specifically earmarking going. It's going to be hard for me to vote with Representative Engen on this bill because I understand the work, and I'll address it later, but this is a protest vote, so I recommend agreeing on our side.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. Representative Engen.
Thank you again. The discussion was very helpful. It is sad still that we're talking about $20 million after how much we spent last session that could have gone towards this. It doesn't make sense to me how we're fighting over that amount of funding, and we know that it's going to be cut out some from OJP and from salaries to nonprofit folks rather than to victims. That's what we're trying to do here. So, again, I'd urge a green vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. The clerk will now take the roll on the A2 amendments.
Chair Mueller.
No.
Chair Mueller votes no. Vice Chair Feist.
No.
Vice Chair Feist votes no. Lead Novotny.
Yes.
Lead Novotny votes yes. Representative Becker-Finn.
No.
Representative Becker-Finn votes no. Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Curran votes no. Representative Engen.
Yes.
Representative Engen votes yes. Representative Frazier.
Nah.
Representative Frazier votes no. Representative Grossel.
Yes.
Representative Grossel votes yes. Representative Hollins.
No.
Representative Hollins votes no. Representative Hudson.
Yes.
Representative Hudson votes yes. Representative Hewitt.
No.
Representative Hewitt votes no. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller votes yes. Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Pinto votes no. Representative Tapke.
No.
Representative Tapke votes no. No. Representative Witte.
Yes.
Representative Witte votes yes.
There being 6 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail. There being no other amendments, we're going to move on to member discussion, and I will just remind folks that we have 3 other bills that we're hearing today, so we're going to keep the conversation to about 5 minutes, but this is being laid over, so we will have more time in the future to discuss this. And I'm just checking to see if I have a list. Oh, you are for sure first on the list, Representative Navani.
Thank you. And I'll try to be brief. And as I said, we have objections to the bill based on a couple of things. And I've seen some heads being shaken over there. And I'd just like to remind some of the heads that are shaking over there when you poo-poo what we're saying, that we don't know what's going on with the system. Many of us have been involved in this system. I first became a reserve officer in Elk River in 1984. That was just after the state law on domestic abuse changed from May to shall. And all of a sudden, domestic abusers who for all their life had been able to not be arrested unless the wife pressed charges short of a domestic charge found themselves going to jail. It had definitely changed things. Some of the most worst drawn out, knockdown flights I had was as a reserve officer and as a young officer when I went full time with people that had been getting away with domestic abuse all their life, and now all of a sudden they were going to jail. We fast forward to where we're at now. I've never once asked the color of the victim when I went to a domestic call. I would suspect anyone else on this side that has gone to a domestic call asked the color of the victim or had that anywhere play into the need for that victim to get help. If you asked me, I'd draft a bill for $40 million because I know the problems that have come with domestic abuse funding. I work closely with my group. I do everything I can to get them funding. I fund them personally. I read this bill and I need clarification. Is this handout from MnCASA to do with this bill? Because this handout supporting this bill that was included in the packet doesn't appear anything to have to do with the bill. And I'll just go on my rant and be done. Federal funding was cut. Unless I'm unaware of something, I don't believe that the federal cut was disproportionate to people of color. I believe that the federal cut overall to these advocacy groups was for everyone, and it didn't matter what the color of your executive director was or your staff or the color they served. That's our problem with the bill. We have the gentleman that testified for the advocacy group that deals with deaf and people that are hard of hearing. This doesn't address them because, as line 17 states, the office shall prioritize culturally specific programs or organizations led and staffed by persons of color that primarily serve communities of color when advocating funds. I'd go up and stand on the floor and do everything I could to get you $40 million if it went to everybody. Picking winners and losers and earmarking funds to specific groups, I don't know of any of these groups that decides what the color of their victim is when they come in and ask for help. And I don't know why we are. I'm at a loss. That is our objection to this bill. Take out everything after line 1.14, survivors, where it starts with services, take the rest of it out. We're a solid green. I'll go to the bank for you.
Thank you. Representative Mueller, response?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am just sort of flummoxed by this conversation. Victims of crime often do have a diverse background, victims of color. I'm sure any of the advocacy programs that are here today would be glad to have this conversation. In the interest of time, I had Kate Weeks up here from OJP to talk further about this and the programs that were traditionally getting funding, and we were leaving out a whole swath of victims that needed to also be getting this funding. So I'm sure any of them would be glad to have that conversation with you. The reality is that all programs need this funding, and that is what our bill is also including all programs in here. So if you want to talk about language changes, we can talk that. Your amendment was something completely different than that, though. So, again, I think it's really important that you have those conversations. I'll note that it also mentions that geographic diversity of the state, we want to make sure that these programs are in all areas and continue to thrive in all areas of our state to help victims throughout the state of Minnesota. So, again, I just would encourage members here to have those conversations and continue to have conversations with me about the bill, because this is the first I'm hearing of that concern.
Thank you. And Director Weeks, would you like to introduce yourself and have a further response? if you want to.
Good morning, everyone. Chair members, my name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs. With the language of the bill and just listening, one of our experiences is traditionally over time, a lot of the funding had gone to what's called mainstream programming, which weren't able to offer things that are really, really important when someone comes in after a violent experience or is experiencing trauma. So the things that, you know, oftentimes I think about in rough times is things that are comforting. Someone who speaks my language, someone who understands culturally, there might be some cultural things that are really important to their healing, to their understanding, having an advocate there that can help them guide through the criminal justice process that might be unfamiliar, and having those supports. It could be as simple as food. It could be as simple as understanding family systems. And so those are really true benefits when we talk about healing and moving through a traumatic experience, is to be able to have a program that's available that brings that kind of understanding and foundation. And so I think that is some of what that language is getting at. I really, really encourage to speak to the advocates in the room who do this every day and can provide real life examples of how that made a difference in a person's world and environment in that healing. I also want to emphasize that this additional funding will not take away from those other programs. This is to add and meet the need in Minnesota.
Thank you so much. So we have a couple of other people signed up to speak, and I'll just remind you that we have three more bills that we're going to get through today, so you can keep it a bit succinct. Next on the list is Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the advocates and the victim survivors that were here to testify today. I was going to speak about how important it is that we have people working in this space, but apparently I need to rewind and talk about why it's important for us to have culturally responsive programs, because I have worked at domestic violence shelters before, and actually when you see people come in that are from majority groups, they have resources that are available to them that other folks don't have. And those are resources that are both programming that is culturally responsive to the majority group, that is white people, and straight and cisgendered people. But also, they have resources outside of that, like families and savings and things like that, that help support them moving forward, that folks who are from minority communities do not have. And I don't know that I need to rewind this far, but I will, because the reality is, people from our communities were not allowed to hold property. We were not allowed to buy homes. Historically, there is a reason why my family is not as far ahead as your family might be, and that is because it's not because they were lazy, it's not because they weren't able to work, it was because that we were held in slavery, it's because we were prohibited from being able to access generational wealth because of our inability to own homes in good areas. And this is an important conversation that we absolutely, I'm sick of having it, but we have to keep having it. The reason why we need these programs for communities that are underrepresented is because they have not had access to this. They do not have the wealth in their family to say, well, I'm just going to stay at my sister's house instead of staying in this house, because they don't have a sister that has a home that has room for their whole family. Like, these are the realities that our communities are facing. And for you to look at this bill, for anybody to look at this bill, I'm not going to direct it at anybody in particular, for anybody to look at this bill and say that this is something that is biased is wrong, because history has been biased against us, and now we are trying to rectify that. That's what equity is. It's not equality, it's equity. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Hollins. So I wanted to I think we do need to correct the record about what's actually in the bill. So it will not surprise you, I'm going to point to a line in the bill. So like line 1.15 talks about the funding must include services for victims in underserved communities. It doesn't say that it's limited to. It says that it must include. And I also want to point out that underserved communities could be communities with disabilities. That deaf culture exists, and there is a deaf community, and that would be fully included in this language. Further, on line 1.17, it says where the state office shall prioritize culturally specific programs, comma, organizations led and staffed by persons of color that primarily serve communities of color. So again, it's not saying that these funds would only be used for those communities. It's saying that it should include them, which I would hope we can all agree with. And to what Representative Hollins pointed out, it is because of the history of this country and our policies up to this point that we are calling out that these things must be included, because without including that language, historically, they have not been. Finally, I'll just say that I think the vilification and diminishment of the work of OJP and advocates who work in the nonprofit space is puzzling. So that's why we've been shaking our heads, because it's puzzling that we would diminish their work as advocates for the sake of whatever was happening in that amendment. So thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this bill forward. It's important. I am very glad it is the first thing we're doing on our regular scheduled day. And I think it's really important that we're having this conversation, even if it's taking up more time than we had planned. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Beckerfin. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Feist. And I'm going to ask a very different question. We're going to go very differently than this. And I appreciate the conversation. I appreciate all the remarks that are happening here. As I have always asked with any type of grants or any type of money that we allocate to OJP, I want to make sure that there is some sort of limit, and that it's because it's not written in here. So I just want to make sure it's going to be following the same rules that only a certain percentage can go to administration. I know that we've had this conversation before about matching funds, because that doesn't always happen with other things. And I know that matching funds can be in different ways, not just funds, but in time served and all those things. Like, I understand that. But, you know, again, one of my principles is that if you can only exist when you're doing some of these things simply because of government funding, then when your community values what you're doing, which we all value what this is doing, but when your community values what you're doing, they're going to invest in that. And so I want to make sure that and that's why it's so important, as we're hearing all of these comments, I want to make sure that all of our communities have different needs and different ideas and different things. The most important part in Austin, we are serving people from all over the world. All over the world comes to Austin who have lots of different needs and different ideas. And so giving money to my community and having them see what they need is super important. But my community also comes around them and supports them. So long way to say, I just want to know the parameters around the grant and making, or the money that's appropriated, and how we're making sure that administration costs are not taking money away from victims, and that we're able to see that there is some community buy-in so that there is actually sustainability.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you. I'm going to answer that community buy-in first. And again, I'm going to point to the letter in the packet that has all of the different people who signed on, including law enforcement, prosecutors, other different government nonprofits that are in our communities throughout the state. So if you want to see community buy-in, I would say look at that letter. I will also note that I toured Alexandra House in Anoka County. They are getting their funding from many different sources. These programs are trying to pull things together with, I don't remember the saying, like a shoestring kind of, in a kind of way, because every dollar matters, and they're trying to access every single lever that they can pull. So I know that the programs are working very hard. It's not like they're just saying, oh, you know, we only, you know, can only rely on the state. But we as the state have a responsibility also to fund these programs fully. So I just want to make that clear. To the extent you have a question about OJP and how much goes to them, Kate Weeks is still here, and I'm hoping she can answer that question.
Thank you. Director Weeks.
Chair members, trying to figure out how to start this, because it is a very, very important question, and we hear it a lot. We have a duty as a state agency and a grantor to make sure that as much money as possible goes out into community for the purposes that you allocate it for. However, also being in this committee, it is very, very important that we balance our fiscal responsibilities and our grant management responsibilities to oversee, to make sure that funding goes for the purposes that you appropriated it for.
So that is a fine balance between those two. OJP right now, we take into several factors when we look at how we staff in order to make sure that we're meeting all of our fiduciary responsibilities around this money. So we do have staff that covers the grant management, which is more of the program side that works very, very closely with the grantees to make sure during the application process, making sure all of the paperwork is ready for them and to do the reimbursement process. We also have fiscal staff that does risk assessments, works on desk reviews, and goes out to make sure that that money is going to exactly where it needs to be going. And that takes resources in order to meet those fiduciary responsibilities. We take approximately 3 to 5%, sometimes it's lower than that, because our priority is to make sure that money goes out the door, because that's what that money is for. So that is where we try and find that balance.
Thank you, Director Weeks. So I had a comment too, and since I have the gavel right now, I get to, like, even though Ellen says we need to hurry up, I just wanted to comment on Representative Ingen talked about the victims as heroes. And they've been through so much, and we saw the power of these types of investments in helping them to, like, thrive and have this full life. And I just think it's important to recognize the public safety impact of this investment, and that so many people who are victims of crime then commit a crime. I've heard that as much as, I think it was over 80% of people who are incarcerated in Minnesota have been the victim of a crime. So I think we need to just think about what we need to do as a state to support victims, and how that all victims need our support, and that's both a moral imperative and a public safety imperative. And with that, I will let Representative Lee Novotny have a comment.
I'll apologize for the intensity before, but I'd just like to point out, I've never said anything in the five sessions that I've been in. My grandparents were sharecroppers. I lied about my age at 15 to get an overnight job and worked a full-time overnight job while still being a small dairy farmer. And I've supported myself entirely from the time I was 15 years old. We didn't have running water in the house because we were losing the farm to bankruptcy from the time I was a senior in high school through college. I showered at school. I washed my clothes at a laundromat. When you look at anyone and make a judgment about that, about them, just based on the color of their skin, I think that is the problem that's going on with this country. And I just wish we'd get away from that and just take everyone and give everyone full value. Thank you, Chair.
Chair Mueller, any final comments?
Yeah, just briefly, I think it's just critically important that all the members of this committee talk to the advocates, the advocacy programs, tour a shelter if you're able to. I think it provides really valuable insight into the important work that these programs provide and the real needs that they have moving forward. So with that, I know we're laying this over, but I look forward to continued discussion on this. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mueller. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 3398. The next bill on today's agenda is House File 3509. This is also Representative Mueller's bill. Representative Mueller, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I think the motion is for it to be referred to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee.
Yes, Representative Mueller moves that House File 3509. If everyone can be quiet as they're coming in and out. Representative Mueller moves that House File 3509 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Representative Mueller, the bill is before us. There are no amendments filed on your bill, so please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So this is an issue related to victim privilege, victim privacy. I could talk for hours about this issue because it is something I have worked on for over a decade. There is a privilege in statute that applies to a lot of different communications that we as a state want to protect. We want people to be able to say things in confidence because those conversations are super helpful. Attorney-client privilege is the first thing that comes to mind. I think everybody's heard of that. Everybody is aware as well of the medical privilege that you have with your medical providers, mental health providers. But we also have in statute privileges for the communications between a sexual assault advocate and a victim survivor, and a domestic violence advocate and a victim survivor. For some reason, the statute has some disparities with regard to how protective that privilege is for domestic violence as opposed to those other privileges, including sexual assault. And so this is really trying to close what I consider is a loophole in that statute and make sure that domestic violence advocates and survivors have that same level of privilege. I am honored today to be joined by Raina Alexander, who has also worked on this issue for longer than I have, but together we've worked on it in my other job as well. And she is just a brilliant when it comes to this topic, and so I look forward to hearing from her.
Okay. Thank you so much. And please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, esteemed members of the committee. My name is Raina Alexander. I am the Director of Finance and a staff attorney at Standpoint, and I'm here to speak in support of House File 3509. And I'm aware of our time limit, so I have I can also talk for hours about this issue, but I have edited even my comments down further, so, but also happy with questions. Domestic violence is an underreported crime, and among the many reasons that victims give for not seeking or reporting for help is that the loss of anonymity and privacy that comes with engaging the criminal justice system. Working with an advocate can provide a safe, confidential, and non-judgmental opportunity for a victim of domestic violence to consider all the various options while addressing any pressing needs, including crisis support and access to services while responding to the trauma they have experienced. In 2008, the Minnesota legislature, without a single no vote or any objection, recognized that the public interest in domestic violence victims' health and safety rises to the level of justifying the creation of a specific privilege protecting confidential information. We are now asking the legislature to update the statute to bring it in line with the sexual assault counselor privilege. Over the last 17 years, I have represented at least 23 domestic and sexual violence programs and had over 800 conversations with attempts to gain access, or when people have tried to attempt to gain access to confidential records against the wishes of the victim survivor. Victim survivors often express a feeling of being re-victimized by the system when their records from a domestic violence program are sought. Domestic violence victims expect and have the right to expect that the fact that they sought help from a domestic violence program will not become known outside that agency. They expect and have the right to expect that the type and extent of services that they will need will remain confidential and private between them and the agency. Victim survivors have the right to expect one thing: confidential, private help with the domestic violence they have experienced. Federal and state laws support that expectation. And Minnesota's domestic abuse advocate privilege needs to be amended so we can honor that right to privacy. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. And we do have one member of the public signed up to testify. That is Andrew Morris. And then if you can make your testimony pretty brief because we're running low on time. Thank you so much. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Absolutely. Once again, for the record, my name is Andy Morris, and I serve as the Public Affairs and Legislative Liaison at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Domestic violence remains a priority within Minnesota's API communities, with survivors often reaching out for help to community-based organizations due to the cultural and linguistically relevant services that only they can provide. This is particularly true in our new arrival communities. Community-based domestic abuse advocacy programs play an indispensable role in supporting and guiding survivors. The bedrock of their work is their ability to build a relationship based on understanding and trust. This legislation would strengthen that foundation and allow survivors of domestic abuse to have the confidence that, in their most vulnerable moments, they can seek the assistance that they need from community advocates for help in achieving emergency shelter, crisis intervention, and other supports and information that can assist them in reaching a safe environment. We urge the committee to support House File 3509. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. And we will move to member discussion. And just as a reminder, this is going to judiciary, so there'll be more opportunities to discuss. Any member discussion? Representative Novotny?
I encourage our members to vote green.
Great. Representative Mueller, any closing comments?
Thank you for that. Let's just move to a vote then.
Fabulous. Members, thank you for this amazing discussion. That's in my notes. Representative Mueller renews the motion that House File 3509 be referred for the first time to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails. I think I'm supposed to do this. There, I did that. And then do we have time for another bill? Oh, we do. Fabulous. Okay. The next bill on today's agenda is House File 3554. This is Representative Mueller bills again. We will be laying this bill over as we await a fiscal note. Therefore, I move to lay over House File 3554. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission recommendation, and I am just going to go directly to the testimony here to explain the bill.
Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nate Reitz. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Spoiler alert, our fiscal note will have no impact on this, so I think you could go to a vote if you wanted to, but that's obviously your call. So this So basically what happened is, this is 3554, correct?
Yes.
So my commission has the duty to make recommendations to the legislature regarding criminal law, and it made 7 recommendations in its report to the legislature this year. This addresses one of those recommendations. Thanks to Chair Mueller for picking this up. And basically what happened is in the late 70s, the legislature created a list of violent crimes where if you repeatedly commit crime on this list, you get a worse penalty, basically, is how it works. It added this crime called first-degree witness tampering. Because of the timing of the creation of another crime at about that same time called aggravated first-degree witness tampering, aggravated first-degree witness tampering didn't make the list, which is irrational because it's more serious of a crime from a statutory maximum point of view, from a sentencing guidelines point of view, and also from the degree of force that's involved or potential threatened force. It could either be the amount of injury or the threatened amount of injury. So we do recommend that the legislature just make the list rational. And that's Section 3 of the bill. And this does that by adding aggravated first-degree witness tampering as well as first-degree witness tampering. And in the course of drafting this bill, your counsel found a couple of other spots where aggravated first-degree witness tampering was missing and first-degree witness tampering was listed. So that's what Section 1 and 2 do. They fix that as well.
Thank you so much. We will move to member discussion. Does anyone have any input? Looks like not. And so we have, based on the fact that there is no fiscal note and Executive Director Reitz was so persuasive, we have made the decision to move this to the House floor. And so I move to place House File 3554 on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails. Are we going to do the last one? Let's go. We will now move on to House File 3520. This is Representative Pinto's bill. This is the last bill on our agenda. And we will be laying this bill over.
Madam Chair, it does not have a fiscal cost, I'm being told.
So if you're very persuasive, we will be convinced that we can move this to the General Register as well.
Madam Chair, I'll give it a try to move House File 3520 to the General Register, and then I'll see if Chair Mueller tells me to change that, or you do, Madam Vice Chair.
I'm just going. Okay. Great. Representative Pinto, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, members, came from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, went to Chair Mueller, and she very kindly allowed me to take it because of my past work against prostitution and against sex trafficking and sexual exploitation. This is simply a conforming change relating to the adjustments that we made through a number of other crimes involving sexual violence and sexual exploitation. And this one, I gather, was just missed. And maybe Mr. Reitz can just confirm that, and we can go straight to discussion and vote.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that's right. In 2021, you may recall changing all the age thresholds for crim sex offenses for child pornography offenses and here child prostitution offenses from under 13 to under 14. Basically, there are 5 places where that change needed to happen in the child prostitution statute. And I'm sorry, there are 6 places where it needed to happen, 5 places it did happen. Missed one. The upshot is if, say, an undercover officer were posing as a 13-year-old child prostitute, basically, it wouldn't be clear which penalty applied, because there's 2 penalties that apply under the law as it's now written, which, again, is irrational and incoherent, and the commission unanimously recommends changing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Member discussion. Seeing no member discussion, we are all very persuaded. Representative Pinto renews your motion to place House File 3520 on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is passed on to the general register. Members, that is all we have on our agenda today, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I got to do that. There.